Artemis 2, Lunar Lessons, and Canadian Contributions. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The race to get the U.S. back to the moon is taking a critical step next month. The second Artemis mission is preparing for launch. The Space Launch System rocket is now on the launch pad with the Orion spacecraft, waiting to take a crew of four on a flyby around the moon and back. We'll speak with Les Johnson, author and former NASA chief technologist, about this mission, what NASA learned from the past Artemis mission, and about the program's future and potential challenges. Then, in that crew of four, is a Canadian astronaut. It's a milestone for the Canadian Space Agency, marking the first time one of its astronauts will fly by the moon. To talk about that significance, we'll speak with Jake Robbins. He's the co-host of the podcast Off Nominal, and he also is a Canadian, too. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? For the first time in over 50 years, NASA is sending humans back to the moon. The Artemis II mission could launch as early as February 6, and teams are working to prepare the SLS rocket and Orion spacecraft that will carry the crew. It's already at its launch pad at Kennedy Space Center. There's a lot riding on this mission. Here to talk more about the mission is Les Johnson. He's a former NASA chief technologist at the Marshall Space Flight Center and author of the book, A Traveler's Guide to the Stars. Les, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Well, thanks for having me.
Les, you've got a pretty interesting background here. We are waiting for Artemis 2, but I really want to chat with you about what we learned on the previous mission, Artemis 1. Really, what did that mission show us about humans' next giant leap to lunar exploration?
Well, the main thing it showed us is that we're capable of going back to the moon with a human spacecraft. You know, we haven't done that since the 1970s. And this rocket and capsule that's going to carry the crew really had to be tested without people on board just to make sure that it was going to be safe and that the next mission, Artemis 2, can carry people. So we've been, for decades now, 50 years, we've been basically circling the Earth in LEO, a few missions slightly above that have gone up for a few days and come back. But we haven't sent anybody beyond Earth orbit since the 70s, and this is a huge, huge change. And Artemis 1 really had to confirm that all the systems would work for that to happen.
It was a very complex mission, but you know, there were certain things that they really were looking at testing, right, including the heat shield and propulsion systems. How did that all perform? I mean, was Artemis, well, did it go as planned?
The mission went as planned. The spacecraft was right on target, did the flyby. They checked out all the systems on board Orion. Everything on the SLS rocket worked like a charm, which is, by the way, very unusual for the first launch of a new rocket. I've personally experienced first launches with a payload on board in the past that did not go well. Fortunately, those were all unmanned vehicles and didn't have quite the engineering review that this one had. But it was the first time for a flight like that, and it was very successful. There were some concerns raised about the heat shield after the reentry. And that's what really delayed the time between the Artemis 1 flight and Artemis 2, is to better characterize some of the damage that was sustained by the heat shield on reentry to the Earth's atmosphere and figure out what they could do to mitigate that and fix the problem.
Les, you mentioned that it was surprisingly successful for being the first of a rocket system to launch. Is that because a lot of this stuff is borrowed from the Apollo program, or is SLS and Orion a brand new spacecraft? Is this all designed from the ground up?
Well, it was a mix. It was not a borrow from the Apollo program. I've had a lot of people ask me, why don't you just rebuild the Saturn V? And my answer is, why would you want to? A lot of the equipment, the steel, the alloys, the electronics, none of that's made anymore, and you really had to do something new. But this vehicle, the SLS, really builds on the heritage of the shuttle and a lot of things we learned from the shuttle program. In fact, when it was originally proposed, I mean, it looked basically like the shuttle orbiter without the shuttle. It had the tank, the solid rocket motors, and replaced the orbiter with a capsule. So the rocket itself has a lot of new in it, but it's derived from really flight-proven hardware from all the flights of the shuttle. The Orion did lift a lot from our history with Apollo, but they had to do it differently. They had to make it bigger because this flight's going to carry four people, not three. And the operations we'll be doing at the moon for the landing, which will come next, are going to require some capabilities that really weren't there for Apollo. It's going to have a capability to do loitering in space for a long period of time, to maybe go to the Gateway, which will be an unmanned station that eventually is placed in lunar orbit as a staging ground before crew goes to the surface. A lot has advanced in capsule and human spaceflight.
And if I'm not mistaken, it will be taking the first toilet around the moon, right?
Yeah, well, the whole life support thing is a huge deal. For Apollo, we were designing the whole program for astronauts to spend, you know, about a week in space and less than a day or so on the moon. But the Artemis program is really a stepping stone to a long duration presence on or around the moon. And when you're thinking about things like that, you think about how you can improve the quality of the trip for the astronauts, and you think about all the systems that are going to be needed to keep them alive and healthy. And one of those would be a toilet instead of, I think, some rather familiar and disgusting things you have to do in a capsule if you don't have a bathroom. Things they didn't talk about much on live TV.
Less, you know, NASA wants that sustained presence. They want to be able to have humans live for long durations around the moon, on the surface of the moon. But in order to get there, as you've mentioned, Artemis 2 has to go well. What is still left to learn with the Artemis 2 mission?
Well, I think the thing left to learn is how all the systems are going to perform with an actual crew on board. There are steps toward validating new technologies that you have before you make them operational. I think the main thing to learn from this flight is everything work as it's supposed to? And if not, why not? So it can be fixed for the next flight. So I wouldn't put a lot of, we're going to learn a whole bunch of new things on this flight. This is more of a, okay, we're going to confirm that what we think we know is true and that we can do it successfully.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media, I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Les Johnson, former NASA chief technologist at Marshall Space Flight Center and author of A Traveler's Guide to the Stars. Les, I'm going to ask you a simple question that I know has a complex answer, but why even go back in the first place?
As someone who wants to see the human expansion into the solar system to use the resources, in my opinion, to eventually help solve problems here on Earth, I think you need to go where you're local, where you learn to live and operate in a deep space environment. It's a lot easier to learn how to build a habitat on the moon than it would be on Mars, because if something goes wrong, you're only about 3 days away. But I think there's also a strategic importance. We're in a strategic competition with China. China has plans to go to the moon and establish a base there. Everybody wants to go to the south pole of the moon. And the reason for that is because it's the only location on the moon that doesn't have a 14-day eclipse or a 14 Earth day lunar night. And if you go anywhere except the South Pole with people, you can't stay after the sun sets because your batteries will soon deplete. There's no sunlight for solar power. We don't have a space-qualified nuclear reactor to power your base, and the people would have to come home or die. But if you go to this small region at the South Pole, you have continuous sunlight due to the axial tilt of the moon. So it is the prime real estate. And it just so happens at the South Pole of the moon, in the craters, there's thought to be a lot of water ice from comets that crashed there many years ago and have been in shadow and barely above absolute zero since that time. So they haven't melted or evaporated since then. So you have water. If you have water, you have drinking, cleaning. You can make rocket fuel by splitting it into hydrogen and oxygen. Finally, in history, the nations and groups of nations, and the Artemis is a group of nations, and the Artemis Accords, many countries are involved in this. We're going to be establishing the open access and the rules of the road for who can go and come from this small area of real estate on the South Pole of the moon. And I think the U.S. strategically wants to set that up as a free passing zone open to all and not claim any territory or land or operational zone around the landing site. And if we're not there first, there's a risk. I'm not saying they would do it, but there's a risk that some other country might say, hey, we're here, you land somewhere else. And there really is nowhere else good to go.
According to NASA's plan, that first landing, those boots on the ground in that area would be Artemis 3, right? After this mission, if it is successful and those lessons are learned. What challenges still remain for that mission?
Well, there's been a lot of in the press about this with the new administrator coming in and the new administration. There is a lot left to be done, unfortunately. The architecture, the plan, is for the lander to be much bigger than the Apollo lander. There are contracts out for the next landing to be with SpaceX, which would take that big rocket's upper stage and turn it into a lander. And they're working on that in partnership with NASA. There's also a contract that NASA's working with Blue Origin to take their Blue Moon Lander concept and adapt that for landing on the moon. The difference is it takes a lot of propellant to get in and out of the gravity well on the moon. And if you're going to stay, you take a lot more with you than you did for the time you spent on the moon in Apollo, which means you need a lot more capable rocket with a lot more fuel. For both the SpaceX and Blue Origin approach, they're going to be launching uncrewed, unmanned vehicles full of propellant that has to transfer in space into a rocket stage to fill up the tank, as it were. So there's enough propellant to get to the moon, to land, to lift off, and come back. And that's going to take multiple rocket launches, in-orbit rendezvous around the Earth, transferring cryogenic or very cold propellants from those tanker vehicles to the rocket and its tank that's going to go to the moon. That hasn't been tested yet. So there are some pretty important demos and milestones that have to be met with all the new hardware you require to get to the surface of the moon that hadn't happened yet. The verdict is still out as to exactly when NASA will be ready to do that. I'm no longer working for NASA. I'm speaking as a private individual. Is that I want to see a couple of really good demos of all those capabilities before we risk putting people on board the vehicle.
Les, finally, beyond that, NASA sees us going from the moon and to Mars. And I know in your book, A Traveler's Guide to the Stars, you analyze how we may one day reach the stars, including whether or not we're able to get to Mars. Is the technical feasibility for us to go from the moon to Mars there, or will it be there? And do you see that there is the political will to do so if and when we successfully land on the moon in Artemis 3 and beyond?
Well, I'll tell you, the technology to send people to and from Mars exists today. Yes, it could be done. It needs to be demonstrated, but it can be done. The problem is, what level of risk are you willing to assume? Mars is a 3-year round trip, best case, where you have to be when the planets launch relative to where each are around the orbit around the sun. You can vary how long you stay on the surface from days to months, and then you have to travel back home. 3 years is a big change from 10 days, right? For life support, for exposure to radiation for the crew and the astronauts, for the psychology of the crew. Can you imagine getting in a camper van with 4 or 5 of your best friends and staying locked in it for 3 years? No. The human factors, I think, really have to be considered here too. From a technological point of view, if we, the U.S. and our partners, wanted to go to Mars and were willing to risk, not a huge risk, but higher risk than we're used to taking in human spaceflight for the U.S., could we go to Mars and come back? The answer is absolutely. Our politicians, if it's going to be a government-led mission, have to decide, is this a wise way to spend the money? Yes, it's a lot of money to you and me, but in terms of the overall federal budget, NASA's spending annually is less than the inflation-adjusted increase every year for Medicare. So in the big picture, we're not spending all that much money on NASA and space exploration, but it would require more than NASA's currently getting to do the Mars mission if it's all government-sponsored. Now, this whole notion of a government-private partnership where some of the money or the hardware comes from private organizations, I think could speed that up dramatically.
Les Johnson is a former NASA chief technologist at Marshall Space Flight Center, author of A Traveler's Guide to the Stars, along with some other science fiction novels, which we will link on our website. Les, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Still to come, a look at an international partnership.
I think once we have, you know, an astronaut around the moon, taking pictures of the moon, that maple leaf there, and he's going to do some, I'm sure there's all sorts of cool outreach events he's going to do. He's probably going to speak French at the moon. I think once those start rolling in, I think you're going to see the enthusiasm ramp up pretty fast.
Canada's role in NASA's mission to the moon. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. The James Webb Space Telescope is making a friend, a new spacecraft called Pandora. The tiny CubeSat will observe things like the atmosphere of exoplanets and their stars, and complement some of JWST's work in the search for exoplanets and life beyond Earth. We'll talk about Pandora, its capabilities, and what scientists may discover in our universe. That's next week on Are We There Yet?
But for now, we're talking about the U.S.'s neighbor. For the first time, a Canadian astronaut will fly around the moon. That's during the upcoming Artemis II mission. The Canadian Space Agency's Jeremy Hansen is a mission specialist on Artemis II. The assignment is a testament to the partnership that's involved in the Artemis program, and it's another example of the U.S. and Canada's collaboration in space. Here to talk more about Canada, space, and Artemis is Jake Robbins. He's the co-host of the podcast Off Nominal, and he happens to be a Canadian himself. Jake, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Good to have you back, Jake. You are a resident Canadian here, so we are going to talk about the the Canadian astronaut on the Artemis II mission, Jeremy Hansen. Tell us a bit about what we know about him and Canada's contribution to this mission.
Jeremy Hansen, he's been with the Canadian Space Agency for quite a long time, actually. You know, we have a pretty small astronaut corps, and we don't always get flight opportunities. So sometimes you have these kind of interesting situations where we have astronauts that are career astronauts and they work for a long time. He was selected in 2009 and this is his first space flight. So it's been a while, you know, that we have had him on the team. But, you know, astronauts do a lot of stuff. So he's been involved with Canadian Space Agency. And then because we're, you know, deeply integrated with NASA, they've been working together all this time. You'll see him on Capcom and working mission control and doing training and all these kinds of things. He's actually one of the important trainers for all of NASA's astronauts as well. So he takes kind of a lead role in those sorts of situations. So he's a fighter pilot, which like a lot of astronauts are. He's got all the flight experience that makes him a good addition to a test flight like Artemis II. We're pretty excited about it.
That's a heck of a first flight for an astronaut going around the moon, right?
You really come out hard with that one and really knock that first flight out of the park for sure.
He will also become the first Canadian to fly around the moon, right? So far, it's only been American astronauts. I mean, what is the significance of that for the Canadian Space Agency?
You can't undersell that. It's only been American astronauts who have ever left low Earth orbit. And if you had, you know, if you knew nothing about this mission and you'd asked yourself in the past, like, which nation is likely to accomplish number two? I don't think Canada would have been the likely pick for that. I mean, you might have gone with Russia or China or maybe the Europeans, right? They have a bigger space agency than us. And then I think that speaks to the relationship our two countries have, right? I mean, we have been partners for a long time. Canada and the United States are very strategic partners in a lot of areas. We create wealth together. Our economies are intricately linked. We defend the world together through NATO and NORAD. And I like to kind of say that our countries are best friends. And now we explore the stars together. And that's pretty cool, too.
This isn't new, Jake, right? I mean, this relationship with the Canadian Space Agency and NASA has been happening for a while. I'm thinking of, you know, just that robotic arm on the International Space Station, right? Tell us a bit about how long this relationship has been and what it's accomplished.
I think it would probably be fair to say that the relationship started with the space shuttle program in earnest, right? I mean, that is when we had our first astronaut corps. You know, our first astronaut selections happened in the early 1980s, and we had our first missions on the space shuttle along with you guys, and that was in return for our contribution of the, you know, the infamous Canadarm. I like to think of it as the very Canadian way to approach space, because it's like this thing that has a very silly name and sounds kind of silly on the surface, but is actually a really critical component of the entire operation. The Canadarm is what the space shuttle used to deploy the Hubble Space Telescope and many other payloads. And so it's a pretty clutch part of that. And so we contribute the arm, and then you fly some of our astronauts to space, and we have a grand old time of it. And so that partnership carried on through the space shuttle program onto the International Space Station, where we conduct missions today. Canadarm 2 is on the International Space Station, plays a very important role capturing spacecraft that are then berthed to the station for cargo and things like that. We also have experience with another arm. This is the less known arm of the space station, which is Dexter. And it's kind of like a little repair robot that it's honestly, it's kind of sci-fi. It like scampers around the outside of the space station and like crawls around from handhold to handhold, and they can do repairs on the outside of the station with that. And so that's our contribution as well. And then we're carrying on that lineage with this flight. You know, this Artemis II flight is partially in exchange for the Canadarm 3, which is the third iteration that's going to go on the gateway around the moon, the lunar, you know, orbiting station. And so we're really excited to be a part of that and continue our heritage of giving you guys a hand, literally, right? So
yes, certainly. U.S. astronauts have kind of dominated, you know, human space flight.
and as you mentioned, Canada has a very small but mighty astronaut corps. Is there the same amount of public interest with Canadians when it comes to human spaceflight? Do people follow it as closely as us Americans?
I would say probably not. You know, it's different when you're not running the program, right? When the mission launches from a NASA facility on a NASA rocket with a NASA mission control, we're along for the ride, and we're proud of what we do up there. But it's definitely a different experience. And you know, it's sad, but the relationship between our countries has been a little tense this year. You know, there's not always the joviality between our talks. There's a lot of stuff going on that's probably muting the enjoyment of this thing. But I'm really hopeful that, you know, this is going to spark a new kind of wave of enthusiasm in Canada, and hopefully maybe help us solve some of our relationship issues that are going on in other domains this time of year. But we had a really enthusiastic response to Commander Hadfield when he went to the space station. He was the first Canadian astronaut to actually command an expedition at the space station. So he was in charge of the space station while he was there. He was really great at outreach. You know, Chris Hadfield is fantastic at connecting with the regular public. And so that was a really good response. And I'm hoping that this will do the same thing, because it's flying a little under the radar right now. But I think once we have, you know, an astronaut around the moon, taking pictures of the moon, that maple leaf there, and he's going to do some, I'm sure there's all sorts of cool outreach events he's going to do. He's probably going to speak French at the moon. That is like, you know, these are like little cultural things that matter a lot to us. And they're, I think once those start rolling in, I think you're going to see the enthusiasm ramp up pretty fast.
Jake, we've heard stories on the International Space Station where, you know, participants, astronauts, cosmonauts, they share a bit of their culture, their nationality through trinkets and food and all sorts of things like that. If you were Jeremy, what would you be bringing on Orion with you to the moon that is truly something that is only Canadian?
That is a great question. I'm curious to see what, if there's any kind of Canadian foods or beverages that make their way up there. That would certainly be something. I don't know if we've seen a poutine in space yet, and definitely haven't seen one around the moon. So that would be really fun to see. What would I bring? That's a really tough question. I don't know if there's a lot. I used to have this, I can see if I can find it, but I had this hockey puck at some point that was signed by Grant Fuhr from the Edmonton Oilers during the cup run in the 1980s. That might be something that I would maybe bring to space and float it around their favorite hockey team logo.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if there is ice underneath the lunar surface, it's probably best to send a Canadian hockey player to skate on.
Exactly. Yeah. We know what to do with ice. We're good at working with it. Yeah.
You're listening to Are We There Yet from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Jake Robbins. He's the co-host of the podcast Off Nominal. Jake, I want to speak a little more broadly about Artemis II now. You have been following the space industry for a very long time. It seems like this moment we've been waiting for a very, very long time, but then it's all of a sudden here. You know, what does it mean to you to actually know that Artemis II is going to launch as early as next month?
It kind of snuck up on us. The challenge with these Artemis missions so far has been cadence. Cadence is not very fast, you know. And if we're trying to do a comparison to the Apollo program, where once that got going, the flights were happening very regularly. You know, it's hard to forget that. We remember that Apollo 11 was in 1969, but Apollo 12 was also in 1969. Like, they were happening that you know, close together. And this mission, you know, the Artemis program has not reached that cadence yet. So we haven't had a flight since, you know, 2023. It's been something like three years and change since the last flight. And that's difficult to maintain, like, an enthusiasm that, like, you know, reaches like some sort of crescendo, right? So that's been tough. And so I would definitely say that this mission snuck up on me. It's always kind of been in the back of my mind. It's a long time away. It's a long time away. And then, oh, here we are. They're rolling it out. And it's time to start thinking about this really seriously. So that's pretty important. The mission itself is pretty clutch. This is the first mission with people. So it's the first time that we're going to be testing really critical, you know, life support technologies and things like that for the Orion capsule. So it's a very important milestone in the whole program. You know, if we do want to send people back to the surface, this is work that has to get done. And so there's going to be a lot of eyes on this. I'm looking for some key, you know, indicators of reliability and robustness and how they respond to adversity and things like that, you know, as the problems that will inevitably crop up.
Longtime listeners of this show, Jake, will know that we had you on quite often in the early years, especially speaking about Mars. That's what you're focused was when you were podcasting back then. And NASA's goal is to successfully utilize authorize Artemis to land us on the moon, set up a permanent settlement there, and then head on to Mars. How feasible is that? And will we see that in our lifetime? I know we're both kind of young.
Yeah. I mean, that's the $1 million question, right? Or maybe it's the $1 billion question would be a more appropriate way to put it. I've become more skeptical of that in the recent years. I think that this is something that comes with experience. You know, the more I learn about the challenges of doing that, both technical and financial and political, because there's a lot that has to go into making something like that happen. It is a non-trivial, you know, endeavor, so to speak. The amount of work that has to go into that means to me that the ultimate success of reaching Mars as a human being is still a ways off. However, what I would say is that we've never been in a time where we're moving towards that as fast as we are now. I think that we have a very fortuitous sort of collection of circumstances where we have a good private sector that is willing to make investments in the space industry. You know, they're thinking about it, they're putting their money in it, they're trying to invent new things. Not all of it works, but eventually technology comes out of that. We're seeing costs go down. We have some political will in terms of, you know, geopolitics. We have a moon program that's on the horizon here where we're going to be able to, you know, in a modern context, evaluate how people respond to space outside of low Earth orbit and in low gravity environments. Like, there's a lot of things happening here that ultimately they don't have a direct line to Mars, but they have a very indirect line to Mars, you know, a very important indirect line to Mars. And so I'm excited about that. I think that it's one of those things where you have to enjoy the journey more so than the destination. So I'm hopefully that's something that everyone can have fun with as we, you know, march on ever forward.
Finally, Jake, Artemis 2 is a critical step in that plan to get humans into deep space. Where are you going to be following along the mission at?
Yeah, I'm going to be watching from my home here in Mexico. I've moved away from the cold, which makes me maybe not a very good Canadian anymore. But yeah, I live south of you now in the Yucatan Peninsula, and so I'll be watching here. I'm going to see if I can rally the troops. We've got a few Canadian immigrants who've come here, and I'm going to see if we can get them together. There's a Canadian bar downtown in my town here, and I think that we could maybe put it up on a screen and have some poutine and some beers. Yeah.
I wish I was down there celebrating with you. That sounds fantastic. We've been speaking with Jake Robbins. He is the co-host of the Off Nominal podcast and our resident Canadian here on Army Area. Jake, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYspace. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you might make a great guest, well, reach out to us. We want to hear from you. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone, and our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.